Good morning, Colorado. You're listening to the Daily Sunup. The Daily Sunup podcast is a conversation with the Colorado Sun. See our trust indicators at coloradosun.com/ethics. It's Friday, April 5th. Today, it's Friday, and once again, time for a look at Colorado's literary landscape. This week, Sun writer and editor Kevin Simpson chats with an author whose new book takes readers on a virtual roller coaster ride through Denver history. Before we begin, did you know Colorado is the second fastest aging state in the nation? Society tells us aging is bad. That's why we need innovative solutions to overcome age bias and empower older adults. Next 50, a Colorado-based foundation, is doing just that. Find out more at next50foundation.org. Now let's go back in time with some Colorado history. On this day in 1851, Hispano settlers began establishing Colorado's oldest permanent settlement, San Luis de la Culebra, in Costilla County, after receiving land from the Mexican government. Their initial attempts were thwarted by the Utes, who saw the valley as a vital hunting ground. Despite a deadly raid in 1851 and a retreat over winter, the settlers returned in 1852, successfully irrigating the land and laying the groundwork for a sustainable community. This marked the first significant alteration of Colorado's landscape for agriculture since the ancestral Puebloans. Now our feature story.
Welcome to Friday, podcast listeners, and thanks for joining us today. You know, there's so many fascinating facets to Denver's colorful history, and today we're talking with a man whose particular specialty is looking at the city through the lens of amusement parks. And there are some names that are going to ring familiar, like Elitch's and Lakeside. But today we're going to take a spin through a lesser-known attraction from the 19th century, and our tour guide is David Forsyth. Welcome, David.
Howdy.
So, David, you're a Denver native, PhD from CU Boulder, and you've written a number of books on Colorado history. This one is called The Amusement Park at Sloan's Lake, The Lost History of Denver's Manhattan Beach. So before we get into specifics, what drew you to amusement parks in general, and how are they significant in Denver's historical narrative?
I've kind of always had a fondness for amusement parks. I guess you could blame it on my first trip to Disneyland when I was nine. I was just fascinated with it and, of course, grew up going to Old Elitch's and Lakeside. And as I sort of became a historian, I actually started out wanting to be a presidential historian, but nobody at CU Boulder would really work with me on that. And every day when I would drive up to class up there, I would go past Lakeside. Kept thinking to myself, I should do something with the history of Lakeside. And when it came time to choose my dissertation topic, everything else I kind of threw out was rejected. And finally, I suggested Lakeside, and everybody got real excited. And the more I dug into it, the more I really became fascinated with amusement park history. And kind of discovered that it was a real different way to kind of look at what was going on in Denver, because everybody reads about the politics and the mining and all this other stuff. But you had all these amusement parks happening. And I always, when I talk about parks and things, I always say, you know, Denver's been trying since day one to prove it's not a cow town. And having all these amusement parks was part of that effort. Most major cities had one or two parks. Denver actually had five during
Holy cow.
these early 1900s. So kind of looking at those parks is just a real interesting way to look at what was going on in Denver and how it tied into bigger things going on in the country.
So tell us a little bit about Manhattan Beach, which was right by Sloan's Lake in Denver. First of all, I'm curious about the name. I know there's a Manhattan Beach in California. I've been there. But how did Manhattan Beach come to be a Denver park? And what sort of entertainment did it feature?
So it actually started out as what I call and what other historians have called a summer resort. A lot of people call them beer gardens, but it wasn't really a beer garden because they didn't serve beer. So it started out as just a summer resort created by Adam Graf, who was an ice cutter on Sloan's Lake. And his original name for it was Sloan's Lake Park. And that was in 1890 when it opened, about 6 weeks after Elitch's opened. So the next year, 1891, they were doing some real heavy renovations to the park, adding a lot of attractions to it. And one of the things that they were adding was a bathing beach. And so the bathing beach was originally just supposed to be called Manhattan Beach. But by the time the park opened for the summer that year, the whole thing had become Manhattan Beach. And really, it was just kind of a common name for amusement parks. You have a few names that you really see showing up over and over again for parks. White City was one of them. Luna Park, Dreamland, which were the two big parks on Coney Island. And so Manhattan Beach was just kind of one of those names that showed up from time to time, and they just happened to choose it for the park here at Sloan's Lake.
So did it feature like rides or entertainment, you know, like live entertainment, or what sort of things drew people there aside from the beer garden?
The original version of the park, it had a hotel, which burned down just ahead of the 1891 season. It had a dance pavilion, and then it had boating out on Sloan's Lake. They had rowboats that you could go out and rent and cruise the lake in. And then it also had a little steamship that they would go out and cruise the lake in. It took about half an hour to take a steamship trip around the lake. So by 1891, when they were doing all the renovations, they added a theater, which Manhattan Beach was really known for during most of its existence, was its theater. And it was patterned after the Auditorium Theater in Chicago. They added a zoo because they were kind of competing with Elitch's. And so at that point, Elitch's had its zoo, it had its theater, so Manhattan Beach had to have that. They still had the rowboats out on the lake. They had picnic pavilions, so you could go out and take picnics out to the park. They really didn't start adding rides to it until 1892. And that's when it got its first merry-go-round, which was actually the first merry-go-round in Denver. And then in 1893, it got its first roller coaster, which was the first roller coaster in Denver. So by the 1892-1893 period, they were starting to add in rides that you would more typically think of as an amusement park attraction.
So I want to interject here and mention that this weekend's sunlit feature spotlights a terrific excerpt from the book that deals with something called the Zoo War, which you mentioned the zoos that Manhattan Beach had, and as well as one of its rivals, Elitch's. So make sure to check that out. But David, give our listeners some backstory on what was going on here with the Zoo Wars. It was fascinating and also kind of hilarious in its own way.
It is. So the star of the Manhattan Beach Zoo was Roger the Elephant. And there's a long history of Roger. He's one of the most legendary parts of Manhattan Beach. But he would give kids rides around the park. And they had ostriches, they had hippopotamuses, they had monkeys, just all kinds of animals. And so at the end of the 1891 season, the park ran into some financial problems. And there had been a man who moved to Denver from Memphis, and he had kind of taken over as the financial backer of the park. And he really wanted to be the owner of the park. So there was some financial stuff going on in the background. And somehow or other, the Elitch's zoo staff became convinced that the Manhattan Beach Zoo staff was not taking care of the animals properly. And they decided they were going to go take them. And so they hired a bunch of private detectives, and kind of in the middle of the night, they made their way from Elitch's to Manhattan Beach with zoo wagons. and you know, went up to the gate and basically made it known that they were there to take the animals. And the Manhattan Beach Zoo staff said, "No, you're not." And there were some guns involved that were drawn. There were no shots fired. My favorite part of it is that they had water cannons hooked into Manhattan Beach's water system, and they let loose with the water cannons on the private detectives from Elitch's. And the newspaper said it was the first time in their lives that some of them had ever taken a bath.
Newspapers had a heyday with this, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. They described the maneuvers as military maneuvers, and it was total military operation the way they wrote about it. Of course, it all ended up in the courts, and Elitch's ended up losing. But yeah, I think it's one of the funniest parts of the park's history.
So you alluded earlier to Roger the Elephant, and I know one of the stories that you mentioned in your Sunlit Q&A that runs with the excerpt on Sunday is the tale of Roger perhaps being buried beneath the parking lot at the present-day King Soofers. What is the backstory on that, and does that question still persist? Is that an ongoing mystery?
The question still does unfortunately persist, even though Nine News and I effectively tried to put it to rest. So as I mentioned, Roger would give rides to kids on his back. They had this special chair that they would put on him, and it would hold five kids. And on July 5th, 1891, he was giving some kids a ride. One of them was six-year-old George Eaton from Denver. And just at the time that Roger started out with these kids on his back, there was a balloon ascension, because balloon ascensions were real common at amusement parks during this time period. Flight was still very much a novelty. And so to see somebody go up in a balloon and then jump out of it in a parachute was a big deal. So just as Roger started out, the balloon went up, and no one was ever certain whether it was the balloon that scared Roger or the crowd rushing over to see the balloon that scared him. But he got scared and started going a little wild. He was really known as a pretty gentle elephant. And so George Eaton, who's riding in the seat on his back, stood up to see the balloon. And as Roger kind of started bucking around, George fell out and Roger trampled him to death. I mean, it was a total accident. He didn't do it on purpose. And, you know, it was actually the first amusement park death in Colorado.
Oh, my gosh. What a tragedy.
It was terrible. And the newspapers, especially the Denver Post and the Rocky Mountain News, tried to outdo each other in how graphically they described the accident and the aftermath. But the story has always been that Roger was put to death because of this and buried in a swamp somewhere near the park. The most common location is in what is now the King Soopers parking lot. There are some other locations that are thrown around. But the fact is, it never happened. I mean, George Eaton was killed, but Roger was never put to death. For one, the park did not own him. He was on loan from the Central Park Zoo in New York, so they didn't have permission to put him to death. And if they had done it, they would have made a spectacle of it, because there were several elephants that were executed on Coney Island during this time, especially if they had gotten out of control. And the parks on Coney Island always made a big spectacle of it. When you actually look at the newspaper articles about the zoo war, Roger was there. So this is, you know, 3 months after the accident that killed George Eaton. The following February of 1892, he's still at the zoo. They talk about him being depressed because of what he had done, and probably also because he wasn't getting enough food. And even into the summer of 1892, he was still at the park. His annual bath in Sloan's Lake was one of the big attractions for Manhattan Beach. And so in July of 1892, they talk about him still taking his bath in the lake. He kind of disappears from the park after 1892. I tried to track him down, and it was kind of an accident that I ran into some reporters from Nine News several years ago who were working on the story. And they were totally convinced he had been killed and buried, and I told them it wasn't true and kind of totally screwed them up. So between the three of us, we really tried tracking him down. I do kind of speculate at the end of the book that he may have actually been sold to the same wild animal show that bought the monkeys from the park a few years later, because the guy had an elephant named Roger, and he exhibited him on Coney Island and at different zoos. Can't prove 100% that it's the Roger from Manhattan Beach, but the one thing I can say for certain is he is not buried in the parking lot of King Soopers.
Okay. Well, there's so many interesting details here, and you dug really deep. Tell us a little bit about how you researched this book. And I know you were working on it during the pandemic, and we've talked to a lot of writers who they all have stories about how the shutdown impacted their ability to work or research whatever projects they had going at the time. So what was your story during that time?
I had actually started the research for this right after my Lakeside book came out. So 2016, 2017. And the intention was to do what I was kind of calling the lost amusement parks of Denver. And so Manhattan Beach would have been one of them. And it was just going to be a chapter or two on each one. And life got in the way. Some other projects got in the way. And so finally, 2020, I sat down to start working on it because couldn't do anything else. It was a good time to work on it. And I decided to start with Manhattan Beach and kind of quickly realized that there was a much bigger story here than I was originally planning on. And so I thought, you know, maybe there is just a book on Manhattan Beach, but it was 2020 and everything was closed. And so the first chapter where I write about the formation of the park and the canal that used to run into Sloan's Lake and everything, that I had the material to do, or I was able to get online. But I very quickly ran out of material when I went to move on from that. And so I just kind of had to sit and wait for a library to open that had the microfilm for the Denver Post and the Rocky Mountain News. And I think it was late June, early July that History Colorado opened their library for appointments. And so once a week I was in there. They limited you to 2 hours. And so I was in there for 2 hours just plowing through newspapers, not even really reading. If it said Manhattan Beach, I just copied it and put it in the cell and took it home. And so I kind of was doing this back and forth where I'd get enough material to move on to the next chapter, work on it on the days I couldn't be doing research. And then, you know, next, soon as I had the next appointment, run down and do research. And when there was talk kind of later in the summer that we might get shut down again, I sort of went into panic mode and started plowing through even faster and making extra appointments. So if we did get shut down again, I would have everything. And also, they do have some papers from the park at History Colorado, which I had been in before. But that was one other thing I made sure that I got into once they reopened, was just to go back into the ledgers and things and see if there was anything I had missed. So it was interesting, you know, just me in a mask by myself sitting at a microfilm machine, plowing through as fast as I could.
Yeah, those were strange times for sure. So you went ahead and you did the book on Manhattan Beach, and now you've got some other ones left that you mentioned. There were a handful in Denver. Tell us about the next subject that you're going to tackle.
The next one I'm working on is on Tuileries, which was the amusement park in Inglewood about Broadway and Floyd. And it was there from 1906 to 1913. It was a couple of beer gardens before that. So it has a history that actually goes back to 1891. And after the amusement park closed, it became a movie studio and then an airplane factory. So it has a very interesting, colorful history. And I'm about two thirds of a chapter away from being done with the very rough draft. But then it's going to need a lot of polishing and kind of filling in some gaps and things. So,
well, that sounds fascinating, just like this one is. And once again, The name of the book is The Amusement Park at Sloan's Lake, The Lost History of Denver's Manhattan Beach by David Forsyth, and it's available at fine bookstores everywhere. Be sure to read the excerpt in this Sunday's Sunlit feature. Thanks so much for joining us, David.
Thanks for having me.
And as always, listeners, if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review on whatever platform you use to tune in. Thanks, and have a great weekend.
You can read more at coloradosun.com. Finally, here are a few stories that you should know about today. Colorado jail leaders are scrambling to find a way to keep funding a new state-mandated program that provides medication and therapy to people in jail who are addicted to opioids. Jail leaders knew a one-time federal grant would help them launch a program to treat people's addiction with medications such as methadone during the initiative's opening year. But with initial $20,000 funding set to dry up by the end of June, jail administrators said they're surprised and frustrated to learn the state is not stepping up with a clear plan to help them pay to keep the program running. The state of Colorado is pitching a plan to buy the Stanley Hotel in Estes Park, a popular tourist attraction that inspired Stephen King's The Shining. The Colorado Educational and Cultural Facilities Authority plans to take over ownership of the hotel after a deal to sell it to an Arizona finance company fell through. The authority will create a subsidiary and borrow up to $450 million in bonds for renovations and upgrades. Once the bonds are repaid, the Stanley Hotel will be used to raise revenue to support educational and cultural facilities across Colorado. Next time you eat a juicy cheeseburger in the western U.S., say thanks to the Colorado River. Researchers say alfalfa, used as feed for beef and dairy cows, sucks up more water than all the cities and industries in the enormous Colorado River Basin. That's according to the most complete accounting so far of how the river's water is used. The research incorporated new factors like water used by nature, Mexico, and out-of-basin water transfers that haven't been counted before. Those numbers show the basin needs to cut water use by 22% to 29% to stabilize historically low reservoirs. For more information on all of these stories, visit our website, coloradosun.com. And don't forget to tune in again next time. Now, a quick message from our team.
This is Michael Booth.
And this is John Ingold. We cover health and climate here at the Colorado Sun.
Every week, John and I work together to send out a newsletter to our premium members called The Temperature.
In this newsletter, we share our latest reporting about health and climate and how they intersect. Issues like forever chemicals, healthcare's rising costs, and the lingering effects of the pandemic. The Temperature is one of our weekly newsletters available to members at the premium level.
To sign up, head to coloradosun.com/join. Not only will you be able to sign up for The Temperature and our other premium newsletters, but you'll be supporting the Colorado Sun as a member, and thanks for doing that.